This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 29th of June 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're continuing our series of Monocle guides to the summer with the season's must-see movies. I'm joined by Tim Robey, film critic for The Telegraph, and David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine, to go through some of the boldest, brashest and biggest budget films out over the coming months. And then we'll take it down a notch to discuss our favourite summertime flicks and the best of the rest on offer on the silver screen. Plus, we'll get the lowdown on the hottest documentaries with our friends at the Bertha Dockhouse and round up the best of this summer's open air cinemas. Dim the lights, get your popcorn at the ready, salty or sweet, and settle down as we head to the movies on this week's edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. And I'm joined in the studio by Tim Robey and David Jenkins. Welcome both to the programme.
Hi.
Hi.
So far this summer, we've already seen two of the biggest blockbusters already, Jurassic World and Mad Max Fury Road. Both have seen massive success. Jurassic World is now the fastest film to make $1 billion at the box office. That's quite a feat to beat. Now, we might not see any other films making quite that impact, but we do have a new Terminator film, a new release from Disney Pixar, and another Marvel film. Lots of big franchises on offer. First of all, Tim, what should we be looking out for? Fury Road, the Mad Max movie, quite a tough act to follow.
That is a very tough act to follow in terms of enjoyment value, and yeah. Jurassic World is a very tough act to follow in terms of just making money. But not really, okay. Not really making sense, if you know what I mean. But yeah, I really can't imagine I'll enjoy the rest of the summer's blockbusters as much as Fury Road, because for me that was like the best action movie.
I sat through that and I thought, I think I'm seeing one of the best films of the year. In fact, I know I am. I had a feeling about it.
Yeah.
It's relentlessly exciting.
I mean, I guess on another page, the Pixar film is a really good Pixar film, Inside Out.
Okay. And talk us through this one then, for viewers that or listeners that are unfamiliar, have yet to Google the trailer on YouTube.
Sure, yeah. Well, the idea here is it's entirely set inside a young girl's head, and the various emotions basically controlling her kind of growth as a person, kind of battle it out together. And so you have anger, you have joy, you have fear, and you have sorrow is the one where the entire movie is about trying to figure out what is even the point of sorrow, this slightly annoying female character.
It gets existential quite quickly.
Yeah, and it's a very elaborate setup, actually. It's a very kind of metaphysically elaborate idea that they've come up with. I think it's really great, and I think it has those kind of Pixar kind of payoff moments towards the end where it really kind of gets you emotionally. It's particularly clever when it occasionally dips inside someone else's brain as well, not just hers, and you realise that everyone is wired differently and has different people in charge, essentially.
Well, it's a tough thing to write, presumably, to get this sort of thing right, and you can tread a lot of people's toes, especially your target audience, by saying, this is what young girls think, this is what people think. I mean, presumably how subtly is it written?
It's true, actually. I mean, she's sort of pre-verbal for quite a lot of it,
right.
But you can see that they've spent a long time on the writing, as they always do, you know, kind of years mapping it all out. But once we're inside her brain and the emotions kind of become the main characters, it's fine. It kind of spins off into its own little world. And it's quite sort of surrealistic, and there's some great bits where they kind of dive inside kind of slightly unfinished areas of her brain, and there's kind of like a weird Dali-esque sequence. And
I love things like this, somewhere between like Fantastic Voyage and weird
that
science.
Kind of thing, exactly.
Yeah.
So I had a hoot with it. It was one of the kind of most purely enjoyable films in Cannes this year, I thought.
I think Pete Docter, the director, has said that it's entirely based on his own relationship with his young daughter and him trying. It's based, as much as it's about children, it's also about parenthood and parents trying to sort of second guess what's going on inside the heads of their children. And maybe it's like a kind of doubles as a sort of parenting guide as well as a comedy.
Well, that's high praise
indeed. Existential comedy.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're going to have a clip from it. This is coming up this summer. It's new from Disney Pixar. It is called Inside Out.
Riley is acting so weird. Why is she acting so weird?
What do you expect? All the islands are down.
Joy would know what to do.
That's it. Until she gets back, we just do what Joy would do.
Great idea. Anger, fear, disgust. How are we supposed to be happy?
Hey, Riley, I've got good news. I found a junior hockey league right here in San Francisco. And get this, tryouts are tomorrow after school. What luck, right?
Hockey.
Uh-oh, what do we do?
Guys, here, you pretend to be Joy.
Won't it be great to be back out on the ice?
Oh, yeah, that sounds fantastic.
What was that? That wasn't anything like Joy.
Because I'm not Joy?
Yeah, no kidding.
That was a clip from Inside Out. Go and see it this summer. Highly regarded by Tim Robey of The Telegraph and David Jenkins of Little White Lies, who's promised that it's half a parenting guide and half a summer blockbuster. Should we talk about The Fantastic Four?
We could do. I'm wondering why with The Fantastic Four. Why again?
I co-signed that question.
It's on our blockbusters list because I suppose that the studios are hoping for it to be a blockbuster, but it's not necessarily following in its own august footsteps.
I mean, the defense of it in a way is that the last round of them didn't work out too well. So it's like you remake the unsuccessful thing. So yeah. you know that makes a certain amount of sense. But I still, the actors involved, Miles Teller, who just kind of broke through with Whiplash, and Michael B. Jordan, who was really great in Fruitvale Station, and the others. You sort of want them to be continuing to do interesting stuff rather than kind of taking
suddenly
the paycheck, which is going to kind of propel them to megastardom. But again, I mean, even the franchises that are making money, like Spider-Man, which is, we've had two rounds of that, and now we're getting a third round of Spider-Man. It's just kind of crazy self-plagiarism.
Is this purely an economic thing, or is this like, we could tap into something here? If we get it right one last time, then this could become a mega brand like Iron Man or something?
I don't know. I just think, I mean, I guess that as soon as Downey Jr. says no more Iron Man, there'll be a new Iron Man. So, I mean, it's all going to be cyclical. I mean, with this Fantastic Four film, I'm not that excited about it, to be frank. And yeah, it definitely does strike me a little bit as slightly kind of flavor of the month casting. You know, we've got these actors who, you know, all of whom probably couldn't carry a Marvel movie on their own, or, you know, be the kind of banner headline star on their own. So we're going to give them each, a quarter of a movie and see how they fare with that.
We can move on to Ant-Man as well
in a minute.
Actually, the kind of concept of Ant-Man interests me much more, because it just seems like it's just more creative and imaginative.
Let's set this up. This is a comic strip character as well. I've only heard of it in terms of looking at this movie and looking forward to this movie.
Yeah, I don't really know the comics, I have to say. I'm not a big comics nerd. What I do know is that Marvel are pushing out as part of their phase three. I've put scare quotes around phase three because it scares me. Phase three scares me. It's like a global takeover mission. It's like we've had two Avengers movies now. We're having a third one, and gradually we're just going to become a corporation that subsumes everyone and everything.
But this is like if the Avengers is Coke. This is like the kind of Dr. Pepper. Or the Lilt.
Yeah, I see what you mean. As long as it's not like Diet Lilt, which is the most revolting drinks in the world. But Paul Rudd is miniaturized, right? So that immediately appeals to me more, because the world is going to be a completely different looking world from any of the other superheroes.
It's Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
It's Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Yeah, with superpowers.
Should we have a clip? And then David's going to jump in on Ant-Man. Not jump on Ant-Man. Because, I mean, what an easy way to kill a superhero. Nonetheless, Paul Rudd is Ant-Man.
If you give godlike powers to everyone, it's going to be chaos.
So how do we stop him?
I know a guy. Scott, I've been watching you for a while. You're different. And I believe everyone deserves a shot at redemption. Do you?
Absolutely. My days of breaking into places and stealing stuff are over. What do you want me to do?
I want you to break into a place and steal some stuff.
Makes sense.
How very exciting the music is for Ant-Man. Was that Michael Douglas?
Yeah, it sounded like Michael Douglas.
And Paul Rudd is Ant-Man. How excited are you about Ant-Man?
I don't know, actually, because, I mean, I must say, I think it was pretty much this time last year that we were in a kind of weird anti-anticipation zone for Guardians of the Galaxy. I don't know if I can speak to you guys, but in the sort of preamble to that, I wasn't that excited by the prospect, and I didn't really know what it was going to be like, and I kind of had it pegged as a disaster, really, because nobody really knew much about it, and then obviously it just exploded, because people need a Marvel movie at that point, at that time, and I guess that Ant-Man seems to be purpose-built as the kind of, this is our Guardians of the Galaxy this year. It's the comedy one.
Right.
You know, we've got the dark ones, the comedy ones, the kind of
got everything
group
you want,
ones,
mate.
You know. Yeah.
I hope that Paul Rudd gets to be funny, because he is such a funny actor. He's such a naturally funny actor. I just hope he's not kind of pressed into the kind of boring hero role and actually gets to be really kind of like a fire off some punchlines. In the trailer, that didn't sound like it. It was like Michael Douglas was getting to be the funny one. But there is hope. I don't think, you know, that Robert Downey Jr. is especially funny as Iron Man. I think in general, the kind of main superhero characters are not funny. And I'm a bit allergic to Joss Whedon's idea of what funny is sometimes. So here, I want them to pull something original out of the bag, right?
Let's close this part of the show out with talking about the elephant in the blockbuster room, Terminator G. I've got, which is an abbreviation, which is unfortunate because I don't know what it stands
Genesis.
For. Genesis. Oh, Genesis.
And that seems to be spelt with a Y at the end, except when it's not. I don't really understand the
Genesis.
Spelling.
Okay, so this is this is Arnie comes back for one last time as a drumming frontman.
Yeah.
Phil Collins.
Exactly. Yeah, you got it. Yeah, Terminator. The Genesis years. Yeah, he's had the Governator years.
Exactly.
Now it's Genesis, yeah. I think this is going to be chaotic, and who knows, it might be funny, it might be partially funny on
purpose.
Can
it be too arch, this kind of thing, you know?
It sounds like they've completely rewritten the entire story in every possible way, and they found excuses to do that. They're like, oh no, we can change the rules there because they've gone back in time to change the rules, so it's fine. We just totally rewrite everything.
Yeah.
We have completely different actors playing, you know, Sarah Connor and John Connor and everyone. It sounds kind of mad, and it sounds like Arnie kind of comes in and is a bit of a stunt, not cameo, because he is certainly the star of the show, but it's sort of a stunt reappearance for Arnie.
He's playing himself.
Partway in. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I was talking to a colleague this morning. We're trying to sort of work out what was the last genuinely successful, good Arnie movie. And you have to go back a long, 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 long time to actually find it.
What do we think it is?
I mean, we settled on Terminator 2, 91.
Mm. In a guilty pleasure way, I might stick up a little bit for Eraser, just because it has him shooting an alligator and saying, your luggage. So, you know, that's...
we're going to close out this blockbuster section. Here is the man himself.
It's all wrong. John sent me here to save you.
From the Terminator that was sent back to kill me, I know, but we already took care of him.
We have been waiting for you.
The time John sent you to, it no longer exists. Everything's changed.
That was a clip from Terminator Genesis, which is one of the blockbusters we've been discussing with Tim Robey and David Jenkins. We're going to knock that bit on the head. We're going to have a little break. We're going to calm things down. We're going to talk about documentaries, because it's not just the blockbusters we're going to be talking about today. Later on, Tim and David will be telling me their picks of all films out this season. But now we're veering off into the world of non-fiction. Our friends at the Bertha Dockhouse here in London have a few tips on documentaries to look out for over the coming months.
The first one is called That Sugar Film, and it opens on the 18th of July at the Bertha Dockhouse Cinema as part of our Food is Power season.
People on this planet are growing sicker every day, and many scientists now believe that fructose has a role to play.
The film is in a similar vein to Morgan Spurlock's Super Size Me. Writer-director Damon Gummo spends 60 days on a high-sugar diet, consuming fruit juices, granola bars, and other products. Damon highlights some of the issues that plague the sugar industry and where sugar lurks on supermarket shelves.
Sugar's not evil, but life is so much better when you get rid of it.
This is Miami Day One.
One of the biggest documentaries to open this summer is Best of Enemies, directed by Morgan Neville and Robert Greene. Morgan Neville was the Oscar-winning director of 20 Feet from Stardom, and in his new film Best of Enemies, he tells the story of the explosive televised debates between the liberal Gore Vidal and the conservative William F. Buckley Jr.
Game. Freedom breeds inequality. Now I'll say it a third time.
No, twice is enough.
During the 1968 Democratic and Republican National Conventions, the two came head-to-head in debates which were the first of their kind on American television and ushered in a new era of televised political debating.
Now listen, you the right of assembly, stop calling me a crypto-Nazi.
Let's stop calling
I'll
names.
You in
let's
your goddamn face, and you'll stay plastered.
If I didn't have movies, life would be pretty boring.
The Wolf Pack opens on the 21st of August at the Bertha Dockhouse screen. Winner of the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival, it was directed by Crystal Moselle.
My parents didn't encourage us to communicate with society, so we were kind of shut off.
So the film is about the Angulo brothers, who all live together in an apartment in New York and are forced to stay in this apartment by their parents. They're not allowed into the outside world. And so all of their experiences and influences come from the films that they watch. Crystal was given incredible access to document them. So she kind of lives with them in the apartment and goes on this incredible journey as they eventually break out into the real world and discover what it's actually like.
This is like 3D, man.
It's very fresh out here.
I remember being very scared of going out into the world.
And that was The Best of Doc House Recommends Best of Enemies. Sounds like an interesting one. Sounds like Frost Nixon has opened up a whole kind of new can of worms for this kind of... The movies about the TV, movies about interviews, they always kind of make good viewing, don't you? Is this one that you guys are looking forward to?
I'm really looking forward to, yeah. And it's a big topical thing, isn't it? I mean, there was so much talk over the British general election about what everyone was doing and the debates and whether the debates were even going to happen and how much impact they might have on the voting and stuff like that. But to go back into the kind of beginnings of telly and the beginnings of when those kind of debates started happening, I think will be fantastic. And I think 20 Feet from Stardom is actually a really good film. So the guy who directed it, I'm up for this.
Yeah. Indeed, yeah. And that kind of goes back into the sort of the untutored early days of TV in a way, when it was all personality. There wasn't preparation. It wasn't like you had men in your ring kind of dusting you down. And do you know what I mean? It wasn't necessarily, although it was pugilistic, it wasn't professionally so, at least at that point. So that's an interesting one. Let's talk about Amy. I think we've all seen that. And that is out, I think, very soon, isn't it? I mean, this is a fantastic one. Asif Kapadia, who made Senna. Was this business as usual for this documentary maker, or did it give you guys any surprise, David?
You know, for this movie, he tells pretty much the entire life story of Amy Winehouse. And, you know, you watch it and you think this could easily have probably been a kind of 5-6 hour epic, you know, six part TV series, because, you know, it's pretty much, I guess, I think it's about 5 years between Senna and Amy. And you guess that this probably took a long time to do and gather all the material up and stitch it together and create this story. I must admit, I'm not entirely as in love with this movie as a lot of people are. I think that there is an element of finger pointing in it about, you know, certain people who may have affected her kind of course in life, and it kind of accepts some testimonies over other testimonies, right. and in building this narrative, I think it tells sometimes more than it shows. And there were just a few elements of it that I think it talks a lot about the kind of the dangers of tabloid media and paparazzi and stalking and you know, invading of privacy. And I think that there's occasions in this film where it kind of uses those tactics itself to tell the story and the way it depicts Amy. And I found that a little uncomfortable. I mean, it's a film I definitely wanted to see again and sort of try and judge it a little bit more.
It was an interesting thing, actually, when a thing that has no voiceover and no sort of datelines and bylines to tell you who people are necessarily, even when you think it is thoroughly uneditorialized, the simple way and manner in which and order in which you display testimony and you show pictures of this and that, and it shows you that maybe the editorial hand is not as light as it would like to think on the tiller.
But that's possibly true. And if there's another thing to be said against it, is that it goes awfully easy on the record company that kind of pushed her into the final tour that she did, and I think they were involved with the making of the film, so that's sort of, you know, that's one of those slightly dodgy areas. But I agree with the finger pointing. I mean I found it a fascinating watch, and it made me think.
I found it very emotional, actually. I found it quite a thing. I mean, it's such a talented person. So, yeah. And it was, you know, it's one of those things that you feel there were so many, as we were saying, it would make a great TV series. There's so many cliffhangers in her life. But crazily enough, you know, such, you know, a long documentary for such a short life as well.
I mean, it did get to me, and I thought it was fascinating. And it made me wonder about the whole process of collaboration and kind of getting these testimonies out of people who the film then decides were kind of instrumental in Amy's downfall, particularly her family, but also ex-partners and things. Mm. And the way that they've been kind of stung, obviously, by the film, in that they're now distancing themselves from it and rejecting it. That is now part and parcel of the way the film will be received. And I think that is certainly interesting. But I mean, in a way, you have to go about it that way. You have to just accumulate as much as you can and then decide what matters. And yeah, perhaps they could have been given their side of the story, if you like, could have been communicated a bit more, but then it would be a 5-hour film.
Yeah. We're going to have to leave it there. That was Amy. We were also talking about Best of Enemies, a couple of the documentaries that we're looking forward to around this table. Before that, we heard from the Bertha Dock House at the Curzon in Bloomsbury, is where that lives. We're going to be taking a little bit of a break, but then we're going to be talking about Tim Robey and David Jenkins' favourite summer movies.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You are tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today, it's our guide to summer cinema. In the studio with me, I have Tim Robey, film critic for the Daily Telegraph, and David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine. We've talked about the biggest films out this summer, the blockbusters. Let's move on to some of your favourite releases. Tim, I know you're a fan of Selfless, which hit cinemas in July.
I've yet to see it, but I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, we're looking forward to it. You're looking down the wrong end of the telescope.
I may be looking forward to it more than most people. This is directed by Tarsem, who made films like Immortals, Mirror Mirror, and The Cell. And I think is like a truly bonkers stylist of a kind that we haven't got enough of anymore. And the thing that interests me is that this film looks very much like a remake of a film from the 60s called Seconds with Rock Hudson. In it, Ben Kingsley's character basically decides to go through a procedure to be sort of reborn as a younger man, Ryan Reynolds. And in the original movie, it was Rock Hudson who came out the other side, as it were. But then weird stuff starts happening. And I'm just hooked on the concept being kind of brought up to date, essentially.
Yeah.
I'm always there in a weird way for Ryan Reynolds' kind of offbeat, strange side projects when he's not trying to be the Green Lantern or whatever.
Yeah, right.
I'm mainly there for Tarsem. I'm hoping that he's come up with something really kind of propulsive and stylish and clever. We'll see.
You've built an empire from the ground up.
Mr. Hale, it's an honor. The man who built New York.
People will insist that your buildings make you immortal. Now, as you slip away, do you feel immortal?
We offer humanity's greatest minds more time to fulfill their potential.
Designed to offer you the very best of the human experience.
It's alive?
An empty vessel.
If we do this, there's no turning back. Your old life is over.
There's another film I was going to suggest that people should see, which is the British film 45 Years, which is out in August. Probably the best British film of this year, I think. I'd be amazed if another one comes along that's as good.
I'd like to be able to tell you everything I'm thinking, but I can't.
Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtney both star in it as a couple nearing their 45th wedding anniversary who discover this dark kind of secret in their marriage that threatens to corrode everything very, very slowly and in a very kind of genteel, kind of English bourgeois way. They don't kind of admit what's happening, but you can kind of see it all breaking apart under the surface.
What is, and who's made it? Sounds like a Joanna Hogg sort of film.
It's the sort of material that she might have taken
it's
on.
The Hogg
actually,
school.
It's the Hogg, yeah, but Hogg. It's actually another director I rate equally highly as Joanna Hogg, which is Andrew Haig, who made Weekend, the gay love story set in Nottingham. And this is his third film, but brilliant. It's a brilliant kind of move away from that subject, I guess, and demonstration of his kind of versatility as a filmmaker.
We're going to have dinner, and then we're going to go to bed, and then we're going to get up. And we'll try and start again.
Just to add, I think that 45, for me so far, 45 Years has the greatest closing shot of any film this year. I mean, it's a real kind of subtle sucker punch, if you can have such a thing. It just sends you through a loop right at the very, very last second of the film.
It's a real shock. I'm looking forward to this. David, what have you got in the arsenal of the Little White Lies to wow us with this summer not a blockbuster?
My favourite film of the year is a film called Eden. It's by a director called Mia Hansen-Love. She's a French director. This is her fourth feature. She's actually appropriating her brother's life, and her brother was a house DJ during the 90s in France. One more
time. Do you like it?
I mean, it's great to dance to, but I don't know that I would listen to it every day at home. One more time.
On one level, it's the story of house music, French house music, which includes people like Daft Punk, and who actually feature in the film, played by actors. And there's a really funny running joke with Daft Punk in there. It turns into this very epic almost literary, novelistic life story about a guy's life and how his love of this music that he DJs over the, you know, around the globe is slightly falling out of favor. And he's kind of coming to this realization that maybe this thing that he's sunk so much of his life and time and energy and emotion into is kind of slipping away from him. It's a really kind of, it's kind of tragedy, but it's kind of laced with, it's very bittersweet, very melancholic.
Sounds fantastic, like a sort of Tolstoy novel about French house music set in the 90s.
It really is.
Amazing.
I mean,
I'm there, yeah.
Yeah, right?
I mean, yeah, again, it's just got, there are all these little directorial flourishes in there, like just little bits of animation. I mean, that makes it sound horribly winsome, but yeah, it's done in this very, very kind of in keeping with the, in the world of the film kind of way. But no, I thoroughly recommend it. I think it's a
sounds fantastic. Our two takeaways, perhaps, from that then are 45 Years and Eden. Well, we've heard all about what's on the big screen, but what about where to watch those films? We've rounded up a few of the best open-air cinema experiences for you around the globe this summer, and here they are.
Paris is the place for a classic. The cinema en plein air à la Villette is showing films by the likes of Kubrick, Hitchcock and Allen, all in their original languages with French subtitles. As well as this, expect short films from promising young directors. Screenings begin at 7:30 from July through to August, and deck chairs cost €7 each.
If you're looking for a theatre with a view, then New York's Rooftop Films Summer Series is for you. The schedule includes over 40 independent and mainstream movies on show in 19 different locations until late August. Head to rooftopfilms.com for more details.
Or alternatively, the Thysaion Open Air Cinema in Athens provides classic flicks such as Vertigo and Roman Holiday with views of the almighty Acropolis until October.
There are plenty of films being shown outdoors in London. In August, head to Film 4's summer screen at Somerset House for premieres, classic, contemporary and cult films with live DJs curating movie-inspired soundtracks. And if you're feeling a little more daring, then head to the Brockwell Lido in South London, where you can enjoy shark attack thriller Jaws from the comfort, or discomfort, of a rubber dinghy in the pool.
And while we're in the water, let's head to Canada for Saline Cinema, the world's first two-sided floating movie experience. From August the 20th until the 22nd, feel free to drop your anchor at either Lake Ontario or Sugar Beach to enjoy an evening screening. And don't worry if you're yachtless, there's room for land folk too. Head to salinecinema.com to vote for this year's films.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Tim Robey, film critic for The Daily Telegraph, and David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine. Thank you very much both for joining me in the studio. You've been tuned in to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.